The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week. It is the greatest Tuesday you've had all week, and it is time for the True Wealth Radio Show. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn, and Matt is not here today, so we have a pinch hitter. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you. We're very happy to be here.
And I'm happy to have you. Now, Emma has been behind the scenes for a while now, but she's officially behind the microphone, mostly because she's super brave. So thank you for being brave.
You're welcome. I'm feeling really brave today.
Yeah, well, and you're looking really brave, whatever that means, right? But anyway, we've still got a remarkable show with a different format than maybe you've heard before, but it might just be exactly what Douglas County needs right now. Because, Emma, explain to me your idea.
Well, my idea, since I'm so new to this industry, I'm new to working with you. I want to start from the bottom. Okay. I want to talk about the basics.
And how do we plan to go about this?
I would like to ask you a lot of questions.
Fun. For me, anyway, I like answering questions.
I like asking questions. This works out.
It does. So here's the thinking. A lot of folks that listen to this program a lot don't have necessarily a tremendous background in finance, but maybe you've been listening over the years, you've picked things up, you may know some things, but some of you don't necessarily know a whole lot. Some of you, you're just, I don't know, it's just the radio station I was on. Whatever the case, this is a chance where Emma came up with a whole bunch of questions, and we're just going to kind of go through them, and I'm going to give her literally fielder's choice about whatever you want to ask, and I'm going to do the best I can to try to answer these in real time. And I think a lot of them are kind of finance oriented, but maybe not finance like, hey, let's talk about the plumbing of the economy, or let's talk about, you know, what's driving stocks or bonds. There may be other questions too, just around, hey, you know, how does somebody even approach finances in this regard, right?
Yeah, and honestly, that's exactly where we're gonna start, because I wanna know if somebody is starting from zero, Or let's be honest, worse than zero if they're in debt, what do they do?
Okay. So, by the way, one of the things I'm going to try to do is make sure I understand the context of the question, right? Because they're not open-ended completely. But when you say starting from zero, you mean like just in what's in their bank account?
Yeah. Financially. They're in their 20s, their 30s, they're fresh out of college, or, you know, fresh on the job market. Mm-hmm. They're not starting with much. Where do they start?
Okay, this is the least popular answer I can conjure. But what you need to assess is, where does your money go? Like the very first thing, this is not a budget, by the way. Okay, budgeting, I think, is kind of like swearing. In finance, you tell somebody like, hey, you need to, you know, go budget yourself. It's like, what did you say? Right? Like, they're gonna pay you picking a fight. Budgets are not a lot of fun for most people. I think it's because it's this idea of, I'm going to pre-restrict everything and I'm going to just take all the fun out of it. But knowing what you're spending on, meaning, hey, what are the budget categories? If I can take a look at what do I spend money on and where does it go, I can get a sense of, am I overspending in some area? Am I accountable to all of my spending? Because a lot of what happens is people sort of fritter their money away. And that, so that it just disappears by accident and not paying attention. I will do something. A similar example would be for folks that over a lifetime put on weight. It's a combination of activity level. It's a combination of aging, but also not being accountable to all the calories. And so they kind of store up, and then all of a sudden you're like, huh, look at that. I didn't mean for that to happen, but it kind of did because I wasn't paying close enough attention. And I think that our finances work the same way. So I would start out with, do you really know what you're spending money on? And that would be the first way I would assess it.
I love that. But how do you get organized, right? Like you equated it to like losing weight and counting calories, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's macros in there. There's sections to break it off into.
Okay.
What constitutes a necessity? What's extra?
Well,
because some people like really just need their coffee. I'm one of those people. So how do you break down those categories?
All right, then let's try, rather than categorizing it first, let's just write it all down. Now, this is going to do something really magical that science has kind of proven out again and again. When you write stuff down, when you track it, you become aware of it, and so your behavior changes. So if you want to change your performance in the gym, start writing down what you're doing in the gym. Keep a journal. Right. If you want to start changing your effectiveness and getting things done, start writing a list of things and crossing them off when they're done. That will change things. The simple act of writing it down, there's some kind of analog connection in our mind that does that. But you start by tracking what you spend. The reason I like writing it down is you could, if you're going to put everything on a credit card or a debit card, which there's some danger in that too, out of the gate, right? If you're young and you're using a credit card and you don't know what you're spending, you're in the danger zone. It doesn't mean you will fall into danger, but you're in a dangerous zone because credit cards are very good at distancing you from your spending, right? You don't feel it the same way as you don't pay attention the same way. That's why I suggest writing it down. But there are apps and things that will they'll basically synchronize with your different financial institutions, and then they'll give you an itemized breakdown of everything you spent, and then you just go in and write down what it was. And the categories start to become kind of obvious. You say, well, this was rent. This was my car payment. This is how much I spent on coffee. This is how much I spent in restaurants. This is what I spent at grocery stores. And you can see, okay, well, there's food and there's coffee and there's eating out. Those are three separate categories. Now, if you eat out at the same restaurant enough times that you have to have a specific category for your favorite restaurant, it's like, all right, I'm at McDonald's every day, then maybe that is your category. Most people, that's not how it's going to work. But I think that you start that way. You write it all down, and then you become familiar with what you're actually doing.
That makes perfect sense. So you talked about habits and how like writing them down will get you to work towards them. But so if you could change one habit, if you could tell people to change one habit, what would you tell them to change?
This is going to seem a little bit of a stretch, but I think the biggest thing would be don't spend money until you have it. Now, this is an interesting one too, because I see people that will say, well, I'm getting paid next week, and so I know that I'm going to put this stuff on a credit card, and then I'll pay the credit card off at the end of the month when I get paid. And they even know how much they're spending. And they are within bounds, if you will, but they're spending it before they got it. I think if you could just flip that equation and wait until you get it before you spend it, do that long enough over time with accountability, and you start to build what we call margin. It's that gap between how much you have and how much you're spending. And so that saving starts to occur because you're waiting to actually get the money. This is also something that entrepreneurs make a mistake with, is let's say that you have a small business and you have a client that says, you know, normally you're going to charge them per month, but they want to pay for the year up front. And so they give you all of the money up front, and then the entrepreneur goes and spends it all. Instead of putting 11 months aside and next month sweeping over another month and another month and another month until they've earned it all, right? Because what the entrepreneur is doing is saying, well, I need the money to run everything, so I'm going to take it and use it now. But now what you've done is you basically use somebody else's money as a line of credit for your next client or yourself. You didn't earn it yet, so you took it and you utilized it before you earned it. And in really small businesses that really should be operating on a cash-based accounting, but they start operating on an accrual-based accounting, if you don't know what that means, you shouldn't be doing it. So that's kind of my take on it.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So it brings up a new question for me, though.
Okay.
When you are young and you're just starting out, how do you build a credit score then?
Ooh, I love to ask the question before that is, how much do you need a credit score? That's sort of the Dave Ramsey question.
You know, when I was younger, when I got into college, I couldn't go get a phone plan.
Okay.
I had a zero credit because I had no credit cards or no debt or anything mm-hmm. that I ever had to show I had to pay anything back. And I had to go buy like prepaid phone cards.
In order to, yeah.
Yeah, instead of getting an actual plan.
So that's a really interesting one. Usually when you hit 18, credit card companies will just start throwing random offers at you. And so it won't be much, but they will offer to start extending you credit if you haven't already sort of run your credit into the ground, right? If you're young and you get a credit card and then you run it all the way up and then you don't pay it off for a little while, then you don't get more credit card offers, right? Because because what you did was, I had credit and I proved it was terrible. So we don't want to do that. I think I'm going to marry these two things together, the previous question and this one. So when you're young, having a credit card to establish credit, this is a toughie. The Dave Ramseys of the world say, don't get a credit card. I'm not that guy. I'm the guy that says, if you're financially responsible, then what you do is you have the money to pay the credit card off before you spend it. And then you can use the credit card to buy the things that you would normally buy. In most cases, it's going to cost you the same either way, because most places don't differentiate between cash and credit price. Some do. Some gas stations do. There's certain vendors that will charge you a credit card fee and so forth. But a lot of them, the price is the price is the price. So in those cases, if you want to do your ordinary spend on a credit card with the understanding that I'm still writing it down, I'm treating it just like I spent it, and then at the end of the month, I 100% pay my credit card off, I would say that's about the safest way that you can start to build some credit, is to do it that way. There are some other programs where they'll let you do a down payment, and what they're doing is they're giving you a credit card-like, but really it's a debit card with a credit feature.
Oh, I like that.
Yep. There are some ways, and they do that with kids too. For parents, they can start teaching kid how to use that. So it's sort of a, you know, debit-backed credit.
Yeah, like a guided experience.
Yep. Yep. So that would be the pathway there. I think where most people miss it is this idea that credit cards give you access to more money than you have in your pocket. So the temptation to spend it is so high that people do it. And then what happens? They're behind the power curve now, and they broke the first rule I shared, which is, why can't people wait to get the money before they spend it, right? The credit card inverts that process, and it's just such a financial weapon of mass destruction in the wrong hands.
I could absolutely see that.
Yeah, yeah.
So what would be the smallest thing that would make the biggest impact that you think that people that are starting out could do?
The smallest thing that would make the biggest impact. Choose what you're going to purchase before you go do it.
No impulse buys.
Don't make impulse buys. Yeah, if you could start with, here's my list, and I'm going to go get the stuff, and if it's not on the list, then I really need to be aware of whether or not I should be buying this.
Sleep on it.
Yeah, I think that impulse buys sap a lot of resources from people. Most of the time, it was a want, not a need. It was something shiny, it got your attention, and you decided to do it. But that's where the slippage occurs.
Have you never done like a panic buy?
Oh,
where you heavens. Get in front of somebody and they're like, don't you just want to buy this? Look at this. And you just, it's so awkward. You just buy it and walk away.
I have bought many things on impulse. I don't want to give the impression that I'm a hypocrite about this stuff. But I think the original question was, what's the small thing that makes a big difference? And in the frame up of, if you're just getting started and you're financially not capable of affording impulse buys, you need to try to avoid the impulse buys. That's a really important thing. If you have built a lot of savings and capacity and you have higher earnings and so forth, and you can afford to do those things, what happens is you're buying flexibility. That's what happens with good financial habits compound over time, and you buy the flexibility back. So this process doesn't have to be heavy-handed for life, but when you're young and you're getting started, that's when it has to be heavy-handed.
Because yeah,
there's
discipline.
There's just no gap, right? And especially today, life is so flippin' expensive.
Yeah, it is.
I know.
Yeah, discipline is really important.
Agreed.
It really is.
So, speaking of discipline, I'm looking at the clock. We're running a little bit long on the first segment. Let's grab a break. We're going to come back. Emma, I'm sure you've got more questions.
I have so many.
I will try to keep answering them, and we will look forward to seeing you on the flip side, everybody. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Emma Art.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where Emma and I are having fun with Q&A today. If you want to catch up, podcast available, you can go to littlejohnfs.com tomorrow. It's at 541 Radio 2 and all those good places. And I just think what you should do is go to your podcast of choice, you know, wherever you get them from, and just subscribe. And then when we put the podcast up, it'll just tell you, like, hey, there's a new podcast. And then you can be all caught up, and we'll share all kinds of fun knowledge with you. But anyway, Emma, you're having fun. Hopefully you're having fun with this.
I'm having a great time. I'm having such a good time.
it's way easier to deal with the microphone than it is to deal with the camera. So
that's not a joke.
It's not. For those of you that don't know, we've been trying to work on live streaming and then recording some of this, and it's complex. Right, the studio is set up for audio, not video, and so we've been sort of working and navigating around it. But yeah, it's a learning curve. So yeah. We'll get there.
The key word was try.
What did you say? The road to hell is paved with good intention.
that's not pretty just accurate.
That is accurate. Oh my gosh. All right. Well, what else have we got for our listeners today? Like, what are some? I'm curious too. Are there any of these questions that like they're genuinely like this is an Emma question, not like an Emma's asking on behalf of the listeners, but like this is an Emma question.
I fully admitted to everybody on the radio that I have a coffee problem. That was so real.
So what you're saying is we got to get a nicer coffee machine at the office you money.
Yeah, you teased about that espresso machine.
No, that's supposed to happen.
It's supposed to happen.
I'm waiting for somebody to pick it out. I don't know about espresso machines. Somebody's got to point me in a direction and say that's the one.
Well, if you let me take over picking out the espresso
machine,
we will have it here next week.
Okay. So everybody heard it, right? Emma, let's find an appropriate espresso machine. But I don't want weird chippiness in the office. Everybody's got to agree that my opinion doesn't matter, but all the people that are like jonesing for espresso or whatever, I don't want it to be like, I can't believe you did this one because of that thing. You got to figure that out, right? Can you get a consensus? There's not that many people. You got to be able to get to consensus on this, right?
Are you saying we need like a daily coffee budget?
No.
Everybody gets one cup a day?
No. I'm saying whatever machine is selected, there's an agreement that machine is adequate. Because if we get it and somebody comes back and goes, oh my gosh, that's a dumpster fire. Why did you put that in the office? Like, I can't hear that. It's just got to be like, oh, this is the best thing.
I will create a whole presentation about it. or better yet, I'll put up like a little informational pamphlet.
We're about to get a bunch of people that are going to be texting the office saying, here's the vote, right? They're all voting for the espresso machine.
We can vote on it. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
I love it. All right. Well, I'm not giving the phone number out yet because a bunch of people will text on it and say, how about this model? And somebody's going to come out with a $35,000 Ferrari version of espresso. And I'm going to be like, no, that one's too much. Just saying, like, even I have limits. I like on the radio, I'm like, there's a threshold where I'm going to be like, you have to try again. I don't like coffee that much.
I do, though.
Well, you can like it the way you like it, but I have to like it enough to like it the way you like it.
It's fair. It's fair. I find good deals.
She is. No, great team player, by the way. So, and if you get to ever deal with Emma, you're probably lucky. If you're dealing with me, uh-oh.
Yeah.
I'm great with financial advice and strategy and figuring all the things out. But when it comes to execution, I've had so many great teammates now that have been covering for me that my skill set in execution is now, hey, Emma, can you do this thing? Hey, Jan, can you do this thing? Hey, Sarah, can you help me with this thing?
It's honestly kind of cracked me up there because there are people like salespeople and they're so adamant that they want to talk to you.
Yes.
And I said, no, if you want him to see it, I have to give it to him and tell him it's worth looking at. I promise I'm the person you want to be talking to.
Like Emma is actually the gatekeeper and it's fantastic. And I love her. So there you go. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's get back to the questions then. So what else besides your coffee addiction are we trying to wade through here?
Well, so how do you stick to a plan, right? If I was going to make a plan to cut back the number of times I go get a cup of coffee in a week and stay disciplined, how do you make a plan and stick to it?
Trap, right? This is sort of like, why do so many people have New Year's resolutions that they don't finish? Why do so many people say they're going to lose weight and they don't? Why do so many people say they're going to someday do X, Y, or Z and they don't? There's a couple of things. One, the steps are probably too big. One of the biggest issues is that folks are saying, oh, well, I want to completely overhaul all of the habits that I have and be a different person. And it's not that it's not possible. It's just that you're really fighting your very own nature here. The idea that you have so much self-discipline that you can just completely rewire all of your habits at the snap of a finger is noble, but probably false. It's just very few people have that level of discipline. And the people that have that level of discipline, they're difficult people to be around a lot of the time, right? It's like they want to do all the hard things. Now, that's kind of cool in some respects, but not all of us are going to be like Navy SEAL types. Yeah. A lot of us are going to be a lot more normal. And it's like, you know what? It's really cold and rainy outside. I don't feel like going outside for a run.
So where's the balance? How do you measure the balance of that?
Well, here's where I would suggest what you're trying to do is play a longer game. And the way that you do this, I'm going to use a term called micro habits. It's the idea that you don't need to make huge changes. You need to make some changes, get those ingrained in your life. And this is why starting by writing something down is really helpful. And then there's two things that I would suggest. One, find a way to make a game out of it. And then two, don't consider a loss of that game as a permanent loss. I'm going to give you a personal example. This is going to seem maybe to some of you dumb, to others of you maybe not so much. I have an app on my phone called Streaks. And it's designed so that I can track each day whether or not I do certain things. One of the things that I can talk about is I have three things that are currently on there, right? I try to read in the Bible every day. I try to do my Duolingo Spanish lesson every day. And I try to do 25 push-ups every day. And my Duolingo streak is really long. It's like 600 and something.
Yes.
Because like I've been doing it for a long time. The Bible one I pretty much started this year. And I'm like 35 or 40 days or whatever for the year. And the push-ups, same thing. I started, and so it's just 25 push-ups every day. I missed once. I just forgot. I was traveling. I didn't do it. And it was like, oh, man. But the next day, I started over. And that was the hardest one, was I wanted to say, like, well, what's the point? This is stupid. You blew it. But now I'm back up to a reasonable number again, and I'm like, well, you're back on the bus. And so I think the trick is, if you fall off the wagon, get back on. So many people view it as like in the diet world, shoot, I ate a cookie. Well, I may as well eat the whole bag. No, you can stop at the cookie you ate. You don't have to eat all of them. Or you don't have to say, well, today is shot, or so the week is shot, so I'll just eat whatever I want. Like, no, you got to. The hardest thing is not never making a mistake. I think the hardest thing is starting over after a mistake with just as much vigor as before the mistake happened. But that's really doable. But that's a mindset shift. And so those micro habits of like, can we just make a tiny change? And if you make a mistake, try a little self-forgiveness, but get back in the groove, right? Keep doing it. That's why I like the app for Streaks, is for me, it's a game, right? So if you can gamify something, then you kind of do it. If you can't gamify something, then whatever it is for you, like whatever motivates you, do that. Some people, it's like, I have to put this picture up and look at it again and again. Okay. Some people, I have to write it down every day. Okay. Figure out the thing that makes you tick, but it's usually something small like that.
Do you think that those are the kind of habits that separate people who are really successful? The knowing what motivates them and using that, and the micro habits? or what would you say that separates the successful people from the less successful people?
I think successful people, and I think we're probably largely using the term financial to define successful, but I think it's broader than that. I think successful people do things intentionally. And that's the single biggest thing. They are more proactive in their strategy. So they look out into the future and say, these are the things that I want. They set those goals out there. And maybe they don't know how to get there, but they know that that's the horizon they're looking toward. And then they just start making incremental progress and they do things. I heard it said once, and I love this, that all a goal is a dream with a deadline. A lot of people have dreams, but they don't set about going to achieve them. And so those dreams are just a mirage. The goal is the thing where you're starting to make incremental progress. And successful people, a lot of the time, they have really ambitious goals. They're working toward them. And to the outside, people look at them and say, wow, they're really successful. You ask them and they say, I have so much farther to go. And so the success is a moving target for them in some respects, but it is iterative and it's growing and moving in a direction. That to me is the difference maker between most people that succeed and those that don't, is they keep showing up and they keep doing things, they keep moving in a direction, and it's not reactive, right? Life isn't just happening to them. They're like, oh, I can't believe this happened again. They're saying, no, I do things with intention. So I think Absolutely. That's really what it is.
I love that.
So cool.
So that kind of leads into my next question.
Okay.
What do you think that people regret most late in their life?
Ooh, the regret question. This is an awesome one. Let's tackle this after this break. So we got to do that. When the music stops, they're going to play fun but very important messages from our sponsors. And then we're going to give it, they're not really our sponsors, but, you know, for the radio station. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
I'm Art.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. Welcome back to the True Wealth Show, where today Emma and I are unpacking all kinds of fun questions. You kind of put it's not a softball question. I mean, you threw a fastball right over the plate on this one and said,
no.
Take a swing here.
Yeah, I kind of boiled the frog. The first questions were fun.
Right? Right.
Now I want the answer, the meaning of life.
Oh, okay. Yikes. All right. That was not the question. I wasn't prepared for this one.
No. I want to know what people regret most later in life from what you've seen.
Gotcha. So I think what people regret most, and this is the closest to being able to be prepared for a question on the show today, by the way, because all these questions, Emma's just kind of bringing to me in real time. This one, I did get to tell her during the break, sort of my take on this. And it's a funky question because I think the regret comes from some form of lost opportunity. And the lost opportunity comes from how selfish or not selfish enough you are. Both dynamics can be sort of an interesting challenge. On the one hand, if you are so like when you're younger, a lot of people say, you know, I lost opportunities that were only going to be available to me in a season of life. And by the way, that's going to happen always. There will always be a trade. You'll get to do one thing or another thing, but you won't always get to do both, because it's going to be a resources or a time or a health trade, or the season is, and I'm going to give you like a very serious example, but like, hey, there's a season to have a family. After a certain amount of time, like that doesn't happen anymore. And if you're saying, well, you could adopt or this, yes, you can, but there's a season that's the most easy to figure out. And then there are other times where if you're going to do that, it's going to be harder. Right? There's a season to be really aggressive with your athletics and so forth. There's a season when training really pays off really well. Then there's a season later in life when training is to hang on. You're not building as much as just hanging on. Maybe you don't like to hear that. Maybe you're like, no, you can always be your best. Well, you can be your best version of yourself at that time. But the fittest of your life may be behind you. You know, if you're 80 years old, you're not going to be fit like you were in your 20s. It's a different season. And so it's the regrets come from the opportunities where people perceive that they made a bad trade. And so that's language that you've probably heard me say before in the office on occasion. The idea of, you know, we're always trading something. Mm-hmm. And the bad trades are the ones where you go, either had the wrong information or I had the wrong priorities. So mm-hmm. I traded working too many late nights and weekends for the time when my children were young. Those are that's time you can't get back. And I hear those sorts of regrets. People that said, I did the job that was safe instead of the job that I was passionate about. And they look back on it and they go, well, that wasn't a great trade. Or the person I never was brave enough to try to ask out on a date. There's a lot of those sorts of things where I think the regret is somebody wasn't brave enough or bold enough, or they lacked the perspective at the time to make a different decision. And so that's what I would say. The biggest regrets are usually the opportunities that weren't taken, not the opportunities that were.
Well, and the opportunities that weren't taken, a lot of that's probably from fear, right?
Yeah, I think I've heard Tony Robbins boil it down to you're either seeking pleasure or avoiding pain.
Yeah.
And so avoiding pain, that's a fear thing.
Well, right? What would you say that keeps people up at night about money? Keeps them up, keeps them afraid.
I think the number one fear is that there won't be enough. You know, where will it come from? You know, money is an interest. Not everybody has that fear. But when you have no money, I think the question is, well, now what? Because whether we care to admit it or not, our society functions by exchanging money, right? It's this mm-hmm. placeholder of value that we use to exchange for things. And there are things that you need in life, right? Food and shelter and so forth. And money is a mechanism for how we trade those things. The folks that need less money tend to have their lifestyle situated in such a way that a lot of those basic needs are covered, so they don't feel the same stress around it. But I would say that scarcity element, that's the fear that drives that. And I don't know. I think there are a certain amount that everybody's got their own things that make them tick about their biggest fear. But if I was looking at the biggest swath of our society, that's probably what their fear is. Is that, you know, I'm not going to have enough, or I'm going to have to work forever, and I'm always going to be sort of paycheck to paycheck. And there's an expression, okay? And it's not trying to pick on the gender thing, but I'm just going to use it as a unisex term. It said, if you want to demoralize a man, pay them just enough to get by. And the idea being that if you put somebody on a treadmill and you give them enough to meet their basic needs but not enough to advance, they have to get on the treadmill and keep going. And it becomes demoralizing because there's no progress. It's just rinse and repeat again and again and again. And so the meaning starts to dissolve. And I think that's part of it. It's just like, what is the point of all of this if I don't have adequate resources? And then there's frustration, and then, you know, that frustration leads to anger and blame and the dark side and Yoda and all that stuff.
I believe it.
Yeah, I made a Star Wars joke in there.
And I can see, too, how the scarcity mindset is a really hard one to get out of. That even when there's not scarcity anymore, that mindset is a really, really hard one to get rid of.
I think it takes a tremendous amount of intention. And I also think it's important to acknowledge that that may be who you are and how you're wired. And it doesn't make it wrong. One of the keys is be aware. I think there's this sense that there's a lot of people that are sort of daredevils that don't experience fear. And I don't think that's very typical. I think most people experience fear. The question is, can you experience it, hold on to it, and still take action anyway? You know, I think soldiers in battle have fear, but in that moment, their training takes over and some of their instincts take over, but they also, they have to face the fear and go deal with it, right? It is what it is. And having that ability to recognize, hey, this is a scarcity challenge, even naming it helps.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of takes the power away from it.
Yeah, a little bit. I think it's hard because it's sort of a, you know, subversive. It's not always at the surface, right? Like, scarcity thinking can be something that's kind of wired as a sub-routine in your system. So you're not necessarily consciously aware of it. It's just there sort of lurking around. And what you're doing is you're sort of grabbing it and shining light on it and saying, hey, I know what this is and this needs to stop. Doesn't mean it just stops, but awareness is a great first step.
Absolutely. Next question. Do you think that fear of like the scarcity, but also that you didn't do the courageous things and the disciplined things with your finances is what makes people fearful to talk about their finances?
I think finances are something that is, it's really personal, and not to get too far down the psychology pathway here, but I think it triggers a lot of shame response. This idea that I should have made better decisions, and I look at the sort of the results or the output of my financial decisions, and people sort of impute some guilt from that, as if, well, my decisions, they weren't that good. So they perceive that they're being judged for those decisions. And the perception is to a certain extent real. I think people do judge other people for those decisions a lot. And that's what makes it hard. I mean, I've said this many times in our office, and that is people would sooner give me their medical history than their financial history. Because with medical, it kind of just happens.
Yeah.
In a lot of respects. And so maybe you have a little bit of a contributing factor, but there's a lot of things where you're like, and then this terrible thing happened. And it's not as if you victimized yourself because of terrible behaviors and all. It's just, that's how medical events happen. They're accidents, right? We didn't plan for those things. So there's a certain amount of, I didn't cause this, so I can report to you what's going on. But financial decisions, I think a lot of people have this feeling of, I caused a lot of this, and therefore there's this sort of guilt complex that comes with it, and this idea that I don't want to experience that judgment. I don't want to be judged negatively. And yeah, I just think it carries a lot of weight for people. There's so much social pressure to keep up and to show wealth through the acquisition of stuff. There's this tremendous social pressure for brand labels and more and more and more. It's awful. But that doesn't mean it's not real. Like that people, they really feel this. Now, whether that perception is reality or not, dirty secret. Here's the secret, everybody. Most people, they don't associate the person with the thing. They see that you have a thing and they go, look at that. And then what do they think about? It'd sure be nice if I had that thing, mm-hmm. right? This thought immediately yep. turns to something selfish. They're not dwelling on you at all. You're not getting judged nearly as much as you think. They're judging themselves while looking at you. And so if you can recognize that, it can really sort of break the cycle of consumerism in some respects. Because, gosh, most of the stuff, I promise you, is not going to make you happy. It's yeah. just going to make you feel like you're missing something. It's a real distraction from where meaning comes from.
Absolutely. I think that too. And I think that along with that, I think that there's a knowing and doing gap. Because I feel like some people, when you talk about finances, like they know that they didn't, like me, I know I shouldn't have gone and bought that coffee. And it's embarrassing, right? I know, but just because I know didn't mean I did better.
So I'm going to do something fun here. So we got to grab a break. Here's the question. I'm going to ask you, Emma, when we come back and put you on the spot a little bit, but she gets a break to think about it. You say it's embarrassing and I want to know why. Let's cover that. And then we'll get through the home stretch. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Emma Arndt.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Show. Emma, I promised our listeners, you made this comment, and I'm just going to let you know in advance, right? I'm not about to like try to make you feel bad about this. I want our listeners to hear this because I think there's a really embedded gem in what you said. You were talking about your coffee purchasing habit,
yeah.
And you used the word that I'm embarrassed that I do this. And I'm kind of calling you on it going like, why did you say that?
Because when you get advice about changing your financial habits, it's like you don't need that expensive coffee every day. And it's not every day, but that's like an example that gets used of like, just be disciplined. You don't need to go buy a $7 cup of coffee. Like, no wonder your budget is like not on track. Like, it's a very common thing that gets judged.
It's fascinating, though, because
right? Who's
doing the judging right now?
I'm judging myself
right now. And that's my question is, I mean, are you doing something that you genuinely can't afford to do?
No. I mean, I can afford to do it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, that's paying me so I can afford the coffee.
Great, yes. But. Hey, living wage, we love that. But also, you're worth it.
Thanks.
But the reason I'm saying is like, it would be different if you were being financially reckless. What you're doing is it's an opportunity cost trade. And in the moment you're saying, well, this brings me a certain amount of comfort.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that's a shame thing, unless what you're saying is, well, there's all these other things I want to do. And if I wasn't buying this doggone coffee, then I could do it. That's
honestly, you know what the trade-off actually was? I was like, you know what? I can make a great tasting coffee at home. And I did. And I made like a caramel chocolate mocha coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned how to make it at home really well, too well. Where instead of having one or two fancy coffees a week, I was making myself a fancy coffee every day. And then all of a sudden I wasn't losing weight because I could just do it myself. So, I'm like, maybe I should just buy the one fancy coffee a week. Because making it myself is too accessible.
You know, it's so complicated because what we like and what we want aren't always natively aligned, right? The problem is, you know, I'm trying to lose some weight, not because I'm morbidly obese or anything, but because at my age and because I'm missing some meniscus in my knee, it would be better for me to be lighter just to take pressure off my joints as I age. But that means I have to fight all these habits I've spent decades building. And all of this excess stored energy that I've packed on has to go somewhere. And the problem is my relationship with food is I like it and I want to eat a lot of it. And the stuff that's not good for me, I like. And so those are not compatible things. I have to make some trades really intentionally. And so I'm trying to learn to like other foods more. And I'm literally like writing stuff. By the way, here's a pro tip. If I'll share this. If anybody wants to try this, I took ChatGPT and I trained it to help me make health decisions. And I can ask it questions about what I'm eating. And it will like kind of be snarky and tell me like, don't eat that. Or, you know, okay, you ate this. Great. Now you get real. You're going to have to change your dinner because of what you just did. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of cool to have this slightly sarcastic buddy on electronically doing it. And if you don't know about it, you put this on your phone, you can take a picture of the food and just say, hey, I'm about to eat this. What do you think? And it'll be like, are you serious? You're going to ruin yourself. Or it'll be like, yeah, you're in the right path. So it's kind of cool. Just saying.
See, I would make a gentle one. Be like, I'm going to tell you this gently, but you shouldn't eat that.
Well, you know, we could tune it to your personality. I needed more like a gym bro that was going to give me a like a hard love kind of thing and be like, that's going to work out great if you want to put on 30 pounds. I'm like, oh, so don't do that? It's like, yeah, that's what I'm putting down. Like, okay.
I got ChatGPT to make me a workout. I was like, here's what I want to do. I've got 12 weeks to do it. What should I do? And it laid out a whole 12-week plan.
Yeah. It knows a lot of stuff. You just have to prompt it the right way so that it gives you, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So, you know, you can't just. And if you don't know how this stuff works, just go to chatgpt.com and then like go play around with it. Get a free account and just monkey around with it. It's really novel. But anyway, we're off the beaten path here. We got like time for maybe one more question, Emma. What do you think?
Oh, one more question.
Yeah. Barely.
That's a hard one.
Yeah, we got like 90 seconds left in the show here.
Okay. Why do smart people still struggle financially?
Because they're very human. Right? Intelligence has nothing to do with this. The smartest people still have to take the action. And I think there's this huge gap. It's not the smartest person that ends up being successful. It's the person that's willing to keep doing stuff again and again. I've known some brilliant people that just wouldn't take action. And so all the brain power in the world, but no activity means you're still basically stuck. And, you know, you can have surprisingly low intelligence, but make sort of simple, good blocking and tackling style decisions again and again and again and do just fine. Intelligence is not the separator of success. I think diligence is a far greater separator. If you can have a combination of both, just, you know, avoid really bad decisions and be diligent, you can be very successful. Like, it's not the smartest person in the room that's usually the most wealthy. Like, it really isn't. So don't let that fool you. It's just, you know, humans make mistakes, period. There's a lot of cognitive biases. There's a lot of things that you think are true that aren't true. And if you study up on it, you realize like, oh man, I put myself in the spot of assuming I was right and I didn't know better. So that just happens.
Yeah. David, I appreciate how real this got.
Yeah.
We got real on the radio.
We did.
Thank you for indulging me in that.
I'm delighted. Thank you for tagging in. Music's playing, so we got to run. Reminder, if you guys want to reach out to us, give us a call, 541-375-0898, or send us an email to info@littlejohnfs.com. Till next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Emma Art.
You've been listening to True Wealth.